huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. For anyone who wants to make money and make a difference, grow and leverage your enterprise better, get more done in less time, outsource everything, and create your ideal lifestyle. And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here. Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. For at least a year, I've wanted to interview this man because I've never met someone who knows as much about negotiation as Simon. And we've been friends now for how long? Must be, what, 7 years?
Yeah, something like that. It must be something like that.
We're like uni friends, aren't we? Where we go to uni together, but then we don't see each other for years. But obviously you've spoken on some of our stages. We've done work together. We created a program together.
We did indeed,
and,
yes.
Which was a great experience. So Simon, I want to say thanks a lot for coming to do the podcast.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Yeah, great. And I've always been interested to see how negotiation changes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 80s, it seemed a bit more like double-breasted suit, power. And maybe we've got a bit more soft and barefoot.
Yeah.
That bare-knuckle negotiation to barefoot negotiation.
Okay.
So how do you see negotiation has changed?
I think what's changed is the, if you like, the buying process that people go through. So if you think about negotiation to begin with, from a kind of as part of a sales process or something like that. What's happened is buyers have changed. It's largely driven by the internet because we're now able to access so much more information.
So we're more savvy, I guess?
Are they better informed or are they potentially misinformed is the question.
Yeah, or
sometimes
over-informed, too much information.
Yeah, because yeah. I mean, I know from my research into neuroscience, like confused brains don't buy for a start.
Yeah.
So it is possible for people to get very confused. But that aside, buyers will often research the person they're going to deal with or the person they're going to negotiate with, you know, using various online resources, or they'll look at lots of different options and they come armed and dangerous with information. So if you look at the way, I suppose, car sales has changed over the years, that people used to kind of go to the garage to find out about the car. Now they've researched the car they want, they've looked online, they're looking at different pricing, and they're probably walking in with their research ready to go. And a recent piece of research showed that in business-to-business selling, so in B2B, buyers are about 57% of the way through the process before a salesperson from the potential supplier is involved.
Right.
So they're a long way through that process. So people are much more, I think, savvy and informed. Potentially, I think there is a higher degree, perhaps, of cynicism now, you know, and people see through that 80s kind of facade. People have more choice, they're better informed, and probably generally there's a greater awareness of the concept of negotiation through programs like Dragon's Den and The Apprentice,
which always make me laugh. Must make you cringe.
Yes, sometimes it's particularly The Apprentice.
Yes,
sometimes I think I almost have to turn it off for the sake of my blood pressure.
Yeah.
Rob, if I'm absolutely...
Well, my favourite bit is when they always say, so shall we negotiate? I mean, surely that's like the worst thing you can do.
Well, the other thing, I think, another thing, a mistake people make is they assume the negotiation is the thing that happens right near the end when we're kind of talking about price and percentages and things. Whereas negotiation starts much, 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 much earlier. And people don't realise they're involved in a negotiation situation.
Yeah.
So anytime you're face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyball with another human being, certainly in a business sense and potentially in a social environment as well, you are negotiating.
Yeah.
You know, which film do you want to go and see at the cinema with your partner? Which restaurant do you want to go with? Trying to get your children to go to bed.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, you'll know that.
Gemma bribed Bobby with hot dog and chips this morning just to get him out of the house.
Yeah. 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 And that's a negotiation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely.
Are we allowed to admit that we bribe our children?
Yes, we all do it. We all do it, whether we admit to it or not.
Ethical bribe.
Ethical bribery. Perfectly okay. You know, yeah. Bobby, if you'll leave on time, then, you know, Mummy will let you have hot dog and chips.
It is the last day of school before half term.
So there we go. Yeah. So we shouldn't be too critical of your nutritional offering to your son.
Yeah, I got him out of the house. I've got a big tractor tire in my garden that I flip.
Excellent.
And because he gets tired near the end of term.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit more difficult to get him to play his golf every day. But I said, look, you can win an Allosaurus, which is his current favourite dinosaur, if you get 20 chips in the tire. Out all morning, chip, chip, chip. So some of the cheap skills still work.
And I would say, be very careful about using negotiation tactics on small children.
Yes.
Because they learn.
Oh my, yeah.
And then, as I found out, when they hit the teenage years, they apply those back to you with some considerable skills.
Well, do you know what Daddy, Bobby said to me recently? He said, Daddy, if you don't do this, I can't remember what, I'll take away your laptop and your iPhone. Oh yeah, he's
like his style, like his style. But yeah, I think that's some of the stuff that's changed. The fundamentals of what is good negotiation, I don't think has changed.
And what are
they? Well, it's, I suppose it is. Where do you focus? If I said, you know, a few things that typify a good negotiator, one is their focus of attention is going to be in on the other person. You know, they want to get outside their own head. They want to get inside the other person's head. You do far more gathering information, seeking information, trying to find out what the other person wants, what's important to them, what are their priorities, why they want it, that enables you then to construct a deal.
Yeah.
So I think a big mistake is often to try to be very, you know, imposing what you want. Having said that, it depends on what style of negotiation you are involved in.
Yeah, and what you speak all around the world, so also culture, I guess, makes
a big culture
difference.
But I think some of the fundamental principles are not different, but the way certain different cultures work in terms of their time orientation, for example, I think America's got quite a, you know, Americans have got quite a rapid culture and they like to achieve things quite quickly, which I think historically is why they've potentially struggled with negotiating with certain countries like the Japanese, where there are certain protocols and things to be followed and observed.
Shoe Dog just came out, the book from Phil Knight, who set up Nike.
Yeah.
And he talked a lot about dealing with the Japanese, much, much slower and really different cultures. That's interesting.
So you have to know that. And so I would say to people, if you are going to be working with a national, and even if you're working inside the kind of just the UK, or I'm sure you get people listening from all sorts of different countries, many countries now are very multicultural and diverse. So I think if you are dealing with someone from a particular culture or background, it's probably worth doing your research on that country, you know, finding out some of the things. Even if that's just to kind of help you understand them and build a bit better rapport.
Yes.
You know, by being, you know, more you know, close to the way they like to behave.
Yeah. So you did gathering information, knowing what's most important to them, getting out of your own head and into theirs. Yeah. Any other fundamentals?
Yeah, I would say there's nothing wrong with giving in negotiation, providing you're getting something of equal or greater commercial value back in return.
Right.
So
yeah.
it's the fundamental principle is nothing for free. You trade, you don't give things for free. So using it like a format, like a conditional proposal, if you do this, then I will do that. And doing it in that format. So for example, if I gave a simple car analogy, you know, if you give me the metallic paint, the alloy wheels and the furry dice, then I could
of course the most important
the furry
thing.
Dice then I could look to buying the car today.
If then the
car salesman says, oh no, the alloy wheels are off the table, not a chance, you can withdraw your proposal. If you did it the other way around and you said, okay Rob, I'm going to buy the car, but I'm only going to buy the car if you give me the metallic paint, the alloy wheels and the furry dice, I've given away a lot of my negotiation power because I've said I'm going to buy the car.
Right.
It makes that condition much weaker and much harder to withdraw it from the table.
Yeah.
So you look at the behavioural profile of a really good negotiator, they'll spend a lot of time on what are called sort of clarifying behaviours, so testing understanding, summarising, gathering information, etc. And that enables them to really understand the other person, get inside the other person's head, and what, you know, what do they want? But then the second question, why do they want it? Why, for example, do they need to move quite quickly? what's the cost to them if they can't do the deal quite quickly? And that might give you some extra leverage or help with the perceived balance of power in the negotiation. And I think power balance as well, I would say, is I train a lot of salespeople to negotiate with buyers, and I also go the other side of the buying table and I train buyers to negotiate, for example, with their suppliers, with salespeople. And as a rough rule of thumb, I'll ask salespeople, and I say to them, I just want a straight answer. Who's got the most power most of the time in your negotiations? Is it you or is it your customer? And I say to them deliberately, what you're not allowed to do is say, it depends. And I use that voice tonality. Yeah. And I don't want some wishy-washy, it depends.
Yeah.
And I go around and I'll say, who's got the power? And they go, customer, customer, us, customer, customer, us. About 70% of the time, salespeople think that the customer's got the power. When I'm working with the buyers, with the customers, and I say, when you're dealing with salespeople, who's got the most power? Repeat the same exercise. About 60% of the time, 70, slightly lower with the buyers normally, they'll say it's the suppliers. Right. Now, unless I have carved out a niche of working with weak organisations around the world, which will be an interesting thing to have achieved.
That's your legacy.
That's my legacy. Who do you, what's your ideal client? Somebody who's really...
wimp.
That cannot be the case. So I think there is a tendency that we tend to overestimate the other person's power and underestimate our own. And what I wouldn't want anybody listening or watching to this to then suddenly turn into some Conan the Barbarian power-crazed figure. Yeah. The answer is... who has the most power? And the answer actually is, it depends. Yeah. And I say that deliberately because I'm trying to force them to make a binary choice to get the underlying beliefs. But the situation is, it absolutely depends on a deal-by-deal, moment-by-moment basis based on where you are in the process, what's happening between you and the other person, how many, for in your world, you know, from a property development point, how many people are interested in the property? Yeah. Have they got the finance? All those sort of things. So power is very dynamic, it shifts, and people need to assess it on an individual deal-by-deal basis.
And what sort of things give people negotiation power at either side?
So, person with the least time usually has the least power.
Yes,
definitely.
Time
is absolute. Person with the least time. I think relative importance of the deal to the person.
How much you need it.
And Jim Camper, who's a great American.
Author. Did he do the something about the no?
Fantastic book. And he was really big. I heard him being interviewed on a podcast like yours, and he was saying, the needier you are, the worse you're going to do. Yes. And almost to the point of saying, you don't need it.
A bit like in dating, isn't it?
Yes.
Been in the wilderness for a few years?
Well, I've been married for 25 years, so that I'm having to cast my mind back a lot. But I guess some needy kind of guy trying to impose himself on someone is probably to lots of women,
exactly, and
vice versa.
And a lot of people back in those days, I always managed to descend conversations. But I remember a lot of people used to say back in the days of, you know, when I was single, they say, oh, well, when I'm not with anyone, no one wants me. And then as soon as I'm with someone, I seem to show interest. And that's probably because you're not giving out wrong signs of desperation and you're showing comfort and strength in who you are when you're with someone.
Yeah, and as I think if I recall correctly on the interview with Jim Camp, the interviewer was reading out some questions people had sent in, and the question was something like, Jim, I really need this deal, tell me what to do. And he said something like...
I need the deal,
as in get a job. Because the guy, I think the guy was self-employed, if I remember, some sort of consultant, and he said, get a job to pay the bills. He said, so then you don't need it.
Yeah.
And the less needy you are, normally the more power you're going to have in the negotiation situation.
Well, in my world of property, the more the vendors need to sell the property, the less we're able to pay. It's almost inverse or directly related, isn't it?
Yeah, and then the other thing is you need to get your kind of rational part of your brain. So from neuroscience, kind of 95% of human thinking, cognition, decision making occurs in sort of the emotional and more primitive regions of the brain. Yeah. So they exert a very strong influence. That 5% is like the prefrontal cortex where you do your rational analysis. That's the bit you need to engage when you're analysing, because a lot of power plays that people will do are designed to impact that emotional part of the brain. So the scarcity thing, you know, the estate agent will always say, please let me know. Take your time, Rob. But obviously, I've got another couple viewing, yes. And there is a second viewing, and they haven't got a chain, or someone else is looking at the car. So the scarcity, the Robert Cialdini scarcity principle.
Okay, so here's I want to ask you something specific about this, because I buy a lot of watches. And there's this one watch dealer I buy from, and they get the best watches, and they use scarcity like that all the time. And I know how it works, because obviously I'm in business. Yeah. And recently they pushed me on a watch. They had other buyers. I was like, nah, they don't, bollocks. They did have, and I lost the watch, and it was a really rare watch, and I'm going to have to wait another 2 years to find one. So, you know, how do you balance the, like, are they telling the truth? Are they just pushing me? But what if you actually do lose the deal?
Yeah, I mean, the point is, I think you have to decide. You have to decide how badly you want, in this case, the watch.
Yeah.
And if you, you know, and you're really into those, and
which I have to forget, otherwise I overpay.
And it's probably a very strongly driven emotional purchase. Yes. You're absolutely fanatical about them, and you love it, and you've got to decide how much you're willing to pay for it, because you will never know. You'll never know for definite whether there are or there aren't. Mm. Over time, you might get to know whether that, if that watch dealer tells you there are five other people after that watch, over time, you'll know that that's probably reasonably true, reasonably accurate, you know. But spotting people lying is a notoriously difficult thing to do, despite some of the nonsense that's
published. Because you've got to get the, how do you get the proof?
Yeah, and that's the point. And
you know, some people say things like, oh, well, if they move their eyes up to the right, that's a lie, that's a tell.
That's in The Negotiator, isn't it, with Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that absolutely unproven.
Of course it is. Because they may, some people are reverse orientated the way they look, according to NLP, so they could look up to the left. Yeah. And people are saying, oh, well, you're trying to create a new image, which is a lie, rather than recall a memory. But if people are oriented the other way around, they're recalling a memory.
And there's also, there isn't very much, if any, evidence, validated evidence that I've seen about eye accessing. So, I mean, I think the eyes are clearly moving around for a reason and for a purpose. And I'm sure NLP has some validity. But I don't think anyone has ever been able to say that is definitively what's happening. So it should take that with a pinch of salt.
Yeah. Do you ever watch the series Lie to Me? Have you ever seen
that? Yes, I've watched pretty much all of those.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, they're interesting, but you think it's not as easy as that.
No,
you know, micro-tells.
Yeah, if people are interested in that, Professor Paul Ekman does have an online micro-expression training thing that you can do. And his stuff, I think, has a lot of validity. But it's going to be a skill and an art that's going to take people some considerable time and discipline to do.
Yeah.
But definitely, there are some. He's got some very interesting data, I think, and findings on that. But scarcity is one of those things that drives people to take action. I mean, another example of power plays are sort of keeping people waiting. You know, if you are particularly if you're in a culture that where time is important. Brits, punctuality is important. Germany, etc., punctuality very important. And so keeping someone waiting is seen as a real
rude. Backfire, though?
Oh, yeah, horrendously.
Yeah. I mean, because surely it's not just about showing power.
No, but it's. I had it done to me when I was a salesperson. I was in fast-moving consumer goods. At one stage, I was heading up a particular sector, and there's one very large client. And I am convinced that when I phoned to make an appointment and I said 10 o'clock, he would put 10:15 or 10:30 in his diary, because he would kind of keep you waiting. And in that situation, we had a long-term working relationship. It was an ongoing kind of power play. Mm. But there are, you know, sometimes I'll say to people, you just got to decide how long you're prepared to wait. Yeah. And then sometimes, you know, after 10 minutes, just go to the receptionist and say, look, I'm really sorry, you know, we've got another meeting scheduled today. Unless we're able to get going in the next 5 minutes, I'm going to suggest we're going to cancel today and reschedule, and then put it back on the other side.
What's the logic for people in doing that?
In terms of keeping you waiting,
it's
kind of like, my time's more important than your time. I'm in a position of power. It's also, Rob, it's controlling. So if you control, the other person as much as you can. So you, for example, say, hey, can we meet on Tuesday? And I'm going to say, no, I can only do Wednesday. And you say, how's the afternoon? So, well, it's going to have to be the morning. And then I'm going to say, well, if you come to us, Rob, that's going to be much easier. Control. I control you by keeping you waiting. Then maybe I come and collect you. Maybe I don't. Maybe I send someone down to fetch you. So that kind of says I'm not You know, I'm not coming down to see you. I'm more important than that. I'm going to send someone. Maybe then I'll show you in the room. Maybe if I do, I might say, in you go, downward voice inflection, take a seat. I might gesture to a particular seat and say, thank you, I've received your agenda. I'd like to talk about item five first. So I've done control, 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 control. And the person may consciously not realise what's kind of happened at that person's start. And it might even be things like, oh, pass me the water.
Yeah.
Downward voice, it's a command. A downward voice inflection is a command. Can you open the window? An upward voice inflection is a question. Can you open the window?
Yeah.
And those are the things that they'll do. Maybe they're outnumbering you. There's one of you. You're expecting a one-on-one meeting. It's now a one-on-three meeting. Sometimes somebody doesn't tell who they are. They might start with a complaint. I had a client. I was speaking for a client in Lisbon. And a lovely guy, and we'd not met previously. I was doing a speaking thing for his company, and we met in early before the event. And I said, how's it been going? And he said, oh, I've just been complaining. And I said, oh, what's wrong? He said, well, nothing really. He said, but I always like to start off with a hotel by complaining. He said, we checked into the room last night, my wife and I, and we complained and they moved us to a nicer room. Mm. He said, so I've just started off by complaining about the event. He said, it's always good to put them on the back foot. And that was...
For years, people have been asking me where I buy my watches. Many of you may know I'm a watch collector, I'm a watch investor, and those as an asset class have done me very well in the last 15 years. I have never shared where I source my watches from or my watch dealer until now. My watch dealer used to be a professional footballer for Manchester United, and he formed a watch brand called Broadwalk. And he sources the higher-end brands like Rolex, Audemars Piguet, Patek Philippe and Richard Mille. I trust him, I've used him for many years, and recently we've done a partnership. Hence, I'm inviting you, if you want to start investing in watches and protect your money from the banks and inflation, to check out Broadwalk. That's Broadwalk. And the website is broadwalkgroup.com. The email is sales@broadwalkgroup.com. And please don't share this, but his number is 07496 878153. Obviously, only message him if you're serious about buying and investing in the higher-end watches. People have been asking me for years, and for the first time ever, you can get access to my watch team.
That was his. And wow. I'm thinking, wow, he's going to start on me next. Yeah, he's going to say, hey, I don't like your suit or something. Yeah. So, and those are all kind of things that
people... Or your shorts.
Oh, my shorts, definitely. Yeah. We're casual today because it's sunny, folks.
Of course. Here's a question about them. Because I'm just thinking, if someone played all those on me, that would that would have the opposite effect, where I would rebel.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I know I'm a bit of a rebel, so I'm probably...
Well, and me too. But think about styles of negotiation, okay? So the power plays are more out there, this hard bargaining sort of win-lose style.
And do you think that's some types of personalities who do that because they think it works?
Absolutely. Some people think that's the way to negotiate. There's all sorts of different styles and ways to negotiate, and a good negotiator has flexibility. Mm-hmm. If you want to build... You know, you and I have had a long-term sort of working relationship. Yeah. So if one of us engaged in some sort of underhand, manipulative, win-lose style of negotiation, we'd probably go, that doesn't fit. That doesn't fit right. So, you know, every year, kind of, we work with large corporate clients, helping them with their sales and negotiation and organisation or leadership and stuff. And 80 to 90% of the business every year is kind of repeat business. You know, it's our model is
relationship.
It's about long-term partnership. So we indulge in very ethical, principled styles of negotiation with those customers. Mm. But when I went to buy my new car last year, and it's a one-off transactional purchase, and then the guy at the BMW garage is a nice guy, but he's a grown adult, he's decided to be a car salesman, I consider it fair game, because the cheaper the price I get, the more advantage to me. So we're in quite a narrow, and even if I really annoy him or really upset him, then he has no power over me. There's nothing he can do. I don't need a relationship with him.
So you'll take more risks, play more games, be a bit harder, more aggressive, power plays. Yeah. It's funny you say that because the first time I saw you speak, I remember you doing some techniques.
Yes.
And sort of the shout, the reaction to get the emotions flowing. And I didn't even know I did this, but typical me. My Ferrari, there's something wrong with it. It's the manifolds, apparently. And like, if you have a Ferrari, you've got to accept there's something wrong with it. So I always get the warranty. and something went wrong with it, wasn't running properly. So I phoned up the RAC. I'll probably have a gold card with the RAC, phoning them up every 5 minutes. They came and picked up the Ferrari and they took it to Grey Paul in Manchester. And the lady phoned me up and she was telling me that, you know, that there's manifolds and these kind of problems. I said, no problem, obviously I've got the warranty, so just sort it. And she said, your warranty expired on the 12th. I was like, what, wait a minute, you always notify me, I always renew my warranty. And I sort of pushed her a bit and I said, look, come on, we always renew the warranty. And in the end she said, no, I'm sorry, we can't do anything. So I said, well, how much is the repair bill? And she said something like $5,000. And it just came out of me and I just effed as loud as I could. I was shocked.
Yeah.
And she went, oh, well, let me go back and see what I can do. And she phoned me back in 3 days and she basically got the $5,000 bill down to just labour at £500 as long as I pay for the warranty renewal, which I would have done 2 weeks ago anyway. Now, my guess is if I could have just accepted and paid that.
Yeah.
It wasn't something I did on purpose. I was just so shocked. $5,500 for two manifolds.
But that is, that's kind of the kind of sudden change of behaviour tactic where, you know, and at your event when I spoke, it was about a double glazing salesman.
Yes, and everyone went, oh!
I did it on. And I did it because, again, it's a one-off transactional purchase. Yeah. But actually, thinking back to it, I didn't like the way he sold. It was very old school, manipulative. You know, what a lovely house you've got, all this sort of nonsense. And if you have all the windows and doors done, you know, this was 14 years ago, so this price is, you know, ridiculous then. It was ridiculous then. It's even more ridiculous if you think about it. You know, it'll be £24,000, you know, and I'm about to flinch, as you should.
Yeah.
You are, you know. And he went, however, if you sign tonight, I'll do it for 12.
Yeah.
You know, and he'd also involved my son in the sale by trying to get him to hold the tape measure to measure him and ingratiate himself. And it was all this manipulative old school selling that I detest with a passion. Yeah. So I kind of thought he was fair game, but I did the effing, you know, lurch towards him. Yeah. And, you know, we settled on some ridiculously low figure eventually. And I made him come back the next day just on a point of principle.
Yeah.
But so that is a tactic some people will use consciously. It sounds like you just used it unconsciously because you were just shocked.
Yeah.
But
I thought about it afterwards. And I thought, interesting.
And the profanity as well is, you don't have to use profanities when you do it, but if you do, they are particularly shocking often because of the impact on the other person. And it is a really dirty tactic. And I would say that the behaviours, but good planning and the right behaviours will always be more effective than some sort of tactics.
Yeah.
But down the win-lose end of the spectrum, tactics have a place, you know, and you can
and maybe you can use tactics in an ethical framework, because no tactic is good or bad, ethical. It's how it's used, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's with intent. I think it was Dave Lacani in his book Persuasion said
his Persuasion books are very good.
I know they're you know, definitely worth a read. And I think if I'm quoting him correctly, apologies Dave if I'm not, it's the difference between persuasion and manipulation is intent.
Yes.
And, you know, and I think an example would be if I came across somebody who was, I don't know, sitting on a bridge and looked like they were kind of suicidal and about to throw themselves off, I think it would be fair, ethical game to use any manipulation I could to get the person away from the edge of the bridge so they can kind of have a think about what they were doing. So in that case, I would say, you know, the intent is to help the person. Mm. I would be as manipulative as necessary in order to
achieve it. Tactical is probably a better way of saying it, isn't it?
Yeah, being very tactical.
Because, you know, if you have got limited supply of your product or service, it's okay to say you've got limited supply. It's just when people lie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like your events. You know, there are you know, you, for a quality reason, you only want a certain number of people in the room. You know, if it turns in, you know, you've only got so much room in your facility.
Yeah.
That's a genuine use of scarcity. The scarcity principle will still work very effectively, but I think when scarcity is based, those tactics are based on truth, they are even more impactful, I think, as well, because you can use them.
Yeah. So let's talk about some stupid mistakes they make on The Apprentice and Dragon's Den.
Okay.
We've got to have a bit of fun here.
Yeah, so Dragon's Den, I think is, I'd separate those two programmes.
Okay.
Definitely. Dragon's Den, if you look at the dragons themselves, I think you've got to realise that what you might see on camera is you're probably seeing a minuscule part of the negotiation. Those are very experienced and successful business people. And so, editing, you know, they're going to be pretty good at it. Yeah. You know, there's going to be no. But it's quite interesting to see. What I would say to learn from Dragon's Den is, I think the rule is you're not allowed to have your numbers with you. You have to know your numbers.
Yeah.
And as a negotiation principle in commercial negotiations, you must know your numbers.
Yes.
You must know your numbers. And you can see they start to probe around. Normally it's around numbers. You know, I will now torture you with mathematics.
Yeah.
And then the person starts to get a bit flustered. And then it all starts to unravel. So I think a big learning from Dragon's Den is know your numbers. And also, sometimes...
So that's back to preparation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Preparation and planning prevents poor performance, and there is a rude version of that. And and in negotiation, it's absolutely true. I think also it's interesting to see, have they fully considered the total value, having one of the dragons as their mentor, as the partner, even if it's in a small partner. So you might give away more than you're happy to give away as a percentage of your company, but if they're going to grow the overall company 10 times more than you're capable of doing so on your own, that might be a value worth paying. So it's worth thinking about value and not always just about kind of price. It's the old Warren Buffett, price is what you pay, value is what you get.
Yeah.
On The Apprentice, I know a few people in television. I am absolutely convinced they have some sort of psychological profiling, and the more narcissistic ones, because it makes good. Because it's about making good television.
Of course it is. Yeah.
And there are some people on that who are decidedly flaky and very, very self-obsessed. And mixed within those, there are a few people who are very good.
Yeah.
Are very, very capable. I think business people. The big mistakes are they're self-obsessed.
Yeah.
They don't think about the other person. On a lot of the tasks, they're under time pressure. And again, the person with the least time has the least power.
Yeah.
And bizarrely, some of them just need to read a very, very basic book on selling and negotiating. Yeah. Some of the selling and negotiating is so unbelievably bad. Yeah. I do wonder how they run their own businesses.
Yeah.
You know, probably the most interesting part is when they are sat down by the various advisors and different people that Alan Sugar brings into, and they're on the one-on-one basis, and then often you see the bluff and the stuff unravel.
Yeah.
But I think the big problem is they're in a competitive situation as well. So that to be fair to them, the competition and the time pressure probably drives quite poor behaviour.
Yeah.
But many of them have a marked inability to think about things from the other, from the customer's perspective or from the other person's perspective. Mm. And that's why. But it makes good television.
Yeah, of course it
makes
does.
Good television.
Yeah, because I think there's a massive difference, which I don't think a lot of people can see, between what is a power play and what is an emotional reaction to one's ego. Because I've seen people say, well, this is my offer and it's the final offer. And then you decline it, and then they say, fine, it's gone up now, and you've got to pay even more. And that's not a negotiation strategy they read in a book. That's their ego going, oh, I got rejected.
Yeah, I think,
and being able to move your ego over there, that's a skill. That's hard for human beings to do.
It is. I think it was Jim Camp who said something like, good negotiators check their egos in at the door.
Yes.
And I'll often, if I'm working
in... And controlling your emotions, not getting upset or angry or...
Absolutely. And not responding to provocation. So there is, you know, within the word negotiation, the word ego sits. There's always an ego in negotiation. There's nothing more expensive to maintain than an insecure ego.
Of course,
you know, and I think actually it does remind me to say that you do need to consider that in a negotiation, and then give the other person something that they can feel like they've had a win, you know, so a win result. So even if you do negotiate a very tough deal, if they feel at least they've won something, you know, they feel they've won something.
Things like, you know, when you're agreeing a price, the last price was offered by them, even though it might be lower than they'd wanted, at least at the end they get to say, well, we finish on this.
And I think a mentor of mine many, many years ago said to me in the midst of a live negotiation situation, you know, let them win, you just keep the money.
Yes.
And so if they're driving away...
Do you want to be right or do you want to be rich?
I mean, if they're driving away, they're going, that Rob Moore, I tucked him up.
Yeah,
aren't I brilliant? And you're sitting there going, this is a really awesome deal.
Yeah.
And if they feel like they've got one over on you, but they haven't, and you're really happy, then that's good negotiation.
Yeah.
You know,
And that's the opposite of ego, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they think. It doesn't matter. You know, But it does, because we deal in commercial, large commercial negotiations inside large corporates, you know, people have to justify themselves to their boss. Mm. So the procurement person has to kind of go, so how did the negotiation go with X supplier? Yeah. The procurement person's got to have something to say to their boss. Hey, I did really well here, and we managed to get this for the sake of their
good
own
point.
Career.
Yeah.
So yeah, it also depends who you're negotiating. Who you're negotiating with. And there is a difference between negotiating with people who own their own businesses.
Of course.
Where they've got all their own skin in the game. Yeah. You know this only too well. You know, when you've got your own business, it's your own money on the line. It's a very different negotiation than when you're negotiating with your company's, your employer's money.
Yeah, because on the one hand, people will spend someone else's money a lot more freely than their own. Yeah. Then on the other hand, you might not be with the buyer or the decision maker. And, you know, it's like they might not have budget for another year.
I mean, you'll see things in commercial, you know, when it's an employer where they say, ah, yeah, okay, yeah, 25, another 25K, that's okay, I can live with that. You're very off. Yeah, it's only 25K. And you kind of go, well, if that 25K was your own money, you know, you wouldn't be quite so, so flippant.
Yeah.
You know,
anyone can spend someone else's money really easily.
It's really easy. So I think that is also understanding, you know, when you're negotiating with people, how much skin have they got in the game, you know, and what's the consequences to them of it not working, and thinking that through.
Which comes back to preparation.
Preparation and planning, you know, is, I do it, I think I exaggerate to make a point, but I'll say kind of 90% of your success as a negotiator is down to planning and preparation. And if people listening in want, if you want to have a massive advantage as a negotiator, plan and prepare, discipline yourself.
I know, because I bet everyone wants from you all the sneaky, sexy, gimmicky tricks.
Yeah, they do. And we can provide them with a few tactics, but they will fail miserably against a very well planned and prepared negotiator who understands negotiation behaviour and uses it effectively and properly. So the better planned and prepared you are, you know, it's not like a massive deal in the overall scheme of things, but we had an email from a guy we'd trained in the IT industry, and they'd had a customer, so they have a thing called change requests, so they're doing the customer's IT infrastructure, quite a big bank in the city. If the customer changes, wants something different, it costs money. But the organisation had a history of kind of, well, let's keep the customer happy and let's not. So they'd set a precedent of doing things that they should be charging for. So the guy attended our seminar, got an email about a couple of days later, and he said, I spent an hour planning and preparing for the negotiation. He said, we spent 45 minutes in a very uncomfortable negotiation. And for the first time, the customers agreed to pay, £47,000 for the change request. Mm. So if you look at that, that's about £22,000-£23,000 per hour.
Yeah.
He's generated from that. And he spent an hour planning, okay? And probably because it was the first time he was using the planning process, you know, it could take. So, you know, an hour's better than half an hour. Half an hour's better than 15 minutes. 15 minutes better than 10 minutes. And 10 minutes is better than nothing at all. We're not saying 10 minutes is world class.
Yeah.
But what do I want to achieve? What do they want to achieve? What are the negotiable issues? What's the likely range? Where's the power balance? Who am I negotiating with? What do I know about them? You know, what questions do I need to ask? What questions do we think they're going to ask? Just some basic, you know, what are some possible scenarios?
Yeah.
And don't make assumptions. Go in with a kind of a blank sheet of paper. Don't make assumptions. Assumptions are very dangerous in negotiation. Don't assume, ask.
Yes.
You know, because, and, you know, if you don't ask, you don't know.
Mm.
And we often see that, you know, we're coaching people in live negotiation situations, which we do sometimes, and we'll say, okay, what do you think their timeline is? They say, well, we think they need to get it done by September. I say, do you know they need to get it done by September, or do you think? I say, well, we think. I say, based on what?
Yeah.
And they go, well, we don't know really. I say, okay, so you don't know the timeline. Mm. So you need to ask.
Well, asking is really powerful because number one, you get information, and number two, people are more comfortable talking about themselves than hearing you speak, aren't they?
Yeah, so encourage them, encourage the other side to talk and to share as much as possible.
Yeah.
And obviously sometimes you do need to share information yourself about what you want, of course. But it's the ratio.
Yeah.
So approximately it will be the good old 2-to-1, twice as much gathering information as you give.
Yeah.
And a big mistake we see a lot of salespeople doing in negotiation situations is giving way too much information talking about what they want and etc. And they don't spend enough time getting inside the other person's head, finding out what they want.
Yeah.
Classic mistake.
Mm.
You know, you are broadcasting when you should be receiving.
Yeah.
Is kind of the phrase.
Mm.
Okay, I tell you something I've experienced a lot that's really interests me is salary negotiations.
Yeah.
Because you can imagine I have 75 staff in the office, probably another 100 out of office. And so it seems like every 4 minutes someone's asking for more money.
Yeah.
And what never works on me, and I don't know how many of my team are going to be listening to this, I might have just cost myself 200 grand here. But you know when people come to you saying, oh Rob, I can't afford to live, you know, I can't even pay the bills, blah, blah. One, it's normally a lie.
Yeah.
And two, I don't feel like I want to save them from their own personal situation, especially when I see them in a nice car and whatever else. But I've had a couple of people that have come to me and said, Rob, in the last year, this is what I've done for the company.
Yeah.
And show me I did this deal, I made this money, I made this money. I haven't had a pay rise for 4 years. In 4 years, inflation has been 15%. And they create a value proposition rather than saying, I have a need.
Yeah.
And I'm always more likely to pay people more money when they show what they've brought and done for the company and the amount of money they've made rather than their need.
It's you kind of get in it the wrong way around, aren't they? You know, because, and they're also showing neediness, potential. Let's assume for a moment they do.
Yeah.
But they're not thinking about it from a Rob perspective, are they? They're not saying, well, because if they prove their value to you, you know, as a business person, your business rests very strongly.
Well, it's an easy decision if it's a value-based proposition, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. You know, you need really good people. And if they can demonstrate value, you show value to the employer, they're more likely to be able to do it. But I think also another thing in salary negotiation is, you know, you need to see things from the other perspective. There may be larger companies that may be some sort of limitations and things because of bandings and things like that. But agreeing, you know, I'm going to give you this. If I give you this, can I have this extra?
Yeah.
Can I have this extra return or de-risk the deal? You know, can you have more bonus, for example, for delivery of things that you're doing?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm with you. You know, I think how people manage their own personal finances and et cetera is kind of their business.
But the thing is as well, if you catch someone lying, you know, it's like you know it's you know, it's like when people, you're doing a deal with a supplier and they say, oh, well, there's no profit in it anymore for me. I'm doing this with no profit. That is a lie, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, it's lying as well. We explore this a lot in our seminars because we do a couple of role play simulations to warm them up. And one is, interestingly, is always about salary.
Yeah.
And I'll always say, who asked how much money, who was asked, sorry, you know, employer, employee, they're in pairs, who was asked how much salary they were currently earning?
Yeah.
You know, show of hands. And how many of you told the truth?
Mm.
Okay, da da da. And who lied? Who actually said, I'm on 75K when you're actually on 50K, whatever the scenario says. And then I go, okay, is it a good idea to lie in negotiation? We start, because there is a grey area. You know, there is this grey area. And I think there is a difference between lying and being careful and considered about what information you reveal at what stage. I mean, I've negotiated in the past on behalf of my employer back in the day with one of the large supermarket chains who invited us to go open book costing with them. So we would show them exactly how much everything in our manufacturing process cost and the supply chain. And then apparently in the spirit of collaboration, we would work together to reduce those costs and share the benefit. And you're kind of going,
you know exactly why you want that information.
Yeah, don't think so. So how, for example, you know, as a supplier, if you're a supplier to someone, how efficiently and effectively you run your business, how well you buy, and how much money you make, I think is your own private commercial business.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody, you know, I don't blame people for asking, but I don't see why you should do that. But as a very, very strong principle with clients, I do not lie to clients.
No. You know, how did you get into negotiation? Give us a sort of the 3-minute radio edit of your life.
Okay, yeah, I left university, wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. Definitely knew I didn't want to do what I'd done my degree in, and I had a couple of dead-end jobs, worked in a warehouse, etc., a couple of things. And I kind of by accident in this company ended up kind of, they asked me to answer the phones in the office to customers and liaise with customers, and I sort of did reasonably well. And then someone has said to me, oh, you know, you ought to try being in sales because you talk a lot, which is bad advice at the time, yeah. but was true, but wasn't yeah. Not the best thing. And then someone else said to me, if you want to move into sales, the best thing to do is go door to door. So like knowing no better, I've got a couple of sort of canvassing jobs in yeah. the evening. So I had like a regular kind of 9-to-5 job in the day. And then went out door to door in the evening. Sky Television, I think, was one of the ones we were on.
Yeah.
If I remember, but, this is you know, long, many, many decades ago, but like 25 quid a deal or something.
Yeah.
So we're making, I realised I was making about kind of back then probably 500 quid a week in the evenings.
Wow.
And much less than that in the day.
Yeah.
And I kind of went, oh, this sales thing's got, but those direct sales things normally reasonably limited time period.
Yeah.
Then got a, went into a telephone sales office and then moved into field sales and yeah. Lucky break, I think, got in with a really good fast moving consumer goods company, very professional company,
yeah.
and benefited hugely from a very good training program, very good sales management, lots of coaching, etc. Stayed in fast moving consumer goods and moved kind of up the ranks to more senior positions, and gradually you start to get exposed to obviously sales, but then more and more you become aware of the concept of negotiation. Mm. And luckily for me, we were trained, the company was very smart. They didn't just train their salespeople to sell, they trained them to negotiate. And so you do both. And eventually, after various things, I ended up heading up their sales academy for them and working, providing all of that stuff. And then after about 18 years, I kind of had enough of working for large corporates, so set up my own organisation. I'd written a couple of books. My first two books, Bareknuckle Selling, Bareknuckle Negotiating.
I loved them books.
I know, we've
both read each other's books.
Of course.
Sometimes you read your friend's books to support them. That was not the case for me. I genuinely enjoyed those. In fact, it might have been your book that got me to get in touch with you in the first place.
I think it was. Yeah. I think you'd read it and then you.
Because was your first one, Bare Knuckle Negotiation?
Yeah.
Just remember the hardcore picture of you with your
yes.
fist. Like, I thought, I need to know this kind of stuff.
We changed that on the second edition.
Yeah.
Got a slightly less embarrassing
cover.
Teddy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I wrote those two books while I still had a proper job.
Oh, right.
And I actually started moonlighting, like to use a few days holiday yeah. to speak and stuff.
Yeah.
And then started to get paid for it. And then so an opportunity came to negotiate an exit and got a few quid,
all
which
right.
gave us a financial cushion. We set up the business in the middle of the recession. Interesting
yeah.
time. And I've been doing that ever since. So we're now, I think it's now 30 countries or something, I think, as I've worked in. So,
yeah, because you speak a lot, don't
I do,
you,
yeah, the yeah, world. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
I know you're really highly regarded in the main Professional Speaking Academy Association, aren't you?
The PSA, I'm a fellow yeah. fellow of the Professional Speaking
Association. Yeah, but I mean, didn't you do a keynote speech at one of their main events?
Yes, I did. Yeah, on house sales, house
very humble for someone who, I'm having to pitch you here.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, if you want to try something a bit nerve-wracking,
yeah.
is you want to speak to speakers,
yes.
And who are all watching you. But it was basically about how to sell yourself more successfully as a yeah. speaker, because it's the same in lots of businesses. The speaking business is no different to any business. You have to be able to market and sell yourself
yes.
successfully. And in the speaking business, there are lots of speakers who are really great speakers, they're really good, but they're not so great at their selling and marketing. Yeah. And that would be same, it could be same. You know,
you know what, it's the same in every business. Sorry to
yeah.
jump in.
Yeah, no,
this
no,
is
no,
an
it
important
is.
Point to make to everyone. I've got a good mate, he's been mates for years, who I do cycling with, and we were cycling this morning, and he's charging £9.50 per hour for, he runs a goalkeeping academy.
Yeah.
So a parent can put their child in for £9.50. £9.50. He should be charging way more than £9.50.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And he's been a goalkeeper coach for 20 years. He's coached England Academy goalkeepers. People have been in the England under 21s, and he's charging £9.50.
Yeah.
Now, okay, he has 100 of them.
Yeah.
But I said to him, that needs to be 15 quid, 20 quid. And so the difference between being able to run a good business and sell and market yourself are huge.
And it applies to any business, whether you are you could be the very best plumber in Peterborough.
Yeah.
You know, you could do a better job than anyone else. But
if no one knows you, then you're not a plumber.
You know, that's not enough. And you have to be able to sell and market yourself. And obviously, selling, so my simple definition, and marketeers would probably throw things at me for saying this, but, you know, marketing is the creation of a potential customer.
Yeah.
Selling turns a potential customer into a paying customer.
Yes.
Selling is convincing the customer of the value of what you have to offer, and negotiation is agreeing the terms
yeah.
upon which you will do business together.
Yes.
So sell first. just to maximise value, then negotiate. Because the more value the customer perceives they're getting from you, your product, your service, whatever it is, the lower their price sensitivity usually, and the high, you know, if it's absolutely what you need, it's absolutely what you want.
Yes.
And also, sometimes there's no negotiation at all.
Yeah, and also you've invested a lot of time, haven't you? One of the things I've learned in negotiation is the more time someone's invested in, the more they feel they've got to lose, or that they've wasted if they then don't go on with the deal.
I mean, actually, that does bring me on to an important point, is a good negotiator does not do every deal.
Yeah.
You only do deals that make commercial and financial sense. And you need, when you're doing your planning, is to work out what your break point is, or your walk away point, or etc.
Like on my watches.
I like on your watches, yeah. And stick to it, because if it doesn't make commercial sense, and you invest a lot of time, and your point's very valid, the more time and energy, the more psychologically it is to walk.
Yeah.
And you start to do all sorts of strange things
in
your brain.
Oh, I've wasted all this time. I've got to go through with this now. Yeah.
You know, I'm sure yields in the area will pick up.
Yeah.
And it's a good investment for the future, and it's a long-term investment. And it's a bad investment.
Yeah.
You know, and we all do post-rationalisation. You know, the brain's very good at conning ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really good idea. No, it wasn't. It was a crappy deal, and you did it because you didn't have the discipline to walk away.
So let's go back to your story then. So how many books have you written now? And
I've written five books. So the first one was Bare Knuckle Selling, and the second one was Bare Knuckle Negotiating. So, and those are probably the books that people know me the most for. I then collaborated with someone I have a close working business relationship with on Bare Knuckle Customer Service, so we're kind of in the trilogy. It was felt I have a master's degree in psychology, and I basically turned my thesis into a book called The Inner Winner, which is like the psychology of performance. And my latest book, which is published by Kogan Page, has been published in, I think it's 6 or 7 languages now, is NeuroSell, which is how neuroscience can power your sales success. So I met a guy who was a neuroscientist, or an applied neuroscientist, an expert in applied neuroscience, and I collaborated. He was my technical advisor.
Yeah.
So it's about what do we understand more of? We now understand more about the human brain than we ever have in sort of human history, because technology allows us to see what's going on. And so what does that mean to sales?
Yeah.
How do we sell more effective by understanding the way the brain functions?
If you saw yourself 10 or 20 years ago, you'd have been able to see some maybe schoolboy errors you made. Can you think of any? You know what? You know.
Oh yeah, I mean, without a shadow of a doubt, I think I was very fortunate at a very early part of my sales career to have a new boss who really took me from being a pretty arrogant, in inverted commas, sales rep into a half decent account manager.
Right.
And I think because at that stage my competence was far exceeded by my confidence.
If you like. Yeah.
So the confidence
Hubris.
Balance.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And we were it was probably my introduction to negotiation planning, and it probably was quite a formative moment, because I took over some big wholesale customers, and the first meeting with a new customer, and he was like one of our gold star, very important, and he absolutely savaged me in the first meeting. You know, was really aggressive and threatening to delist our company, and really, unless we gave him better, and absolutely ran me ragged. So I sort of like managed to get out and escape, and I get on the phone to my boss and said, Philip, he's going to delist us. And he said, okay, well, make arrange another meeting, and he said, whatever. And then when I said it's 2 o'clock on next Tuesday, and he said, excellent, we'll meet at 9 o'clock then. And I'm kind of going, why are we meeting at 9? Because we're going to plan for the negotiation. I'm going, well, I've got 9, 10, 11. How long is this going to take?
Yeah.
So he sits me down in this hotel foyer, we're having a cup of coffee, and he said, now, how good do you think you are at negotiation then? So this is negotiation. I said, I'm sure I'm pretty excellent. He said, excellent. He said, so why don't you take me through the 5 stages that most negotiations go through then? And I went, okay, so stage 1, that's going to be the, and I start waffling, and he went, you don't know, do you? And I went, no. He said, okay, shut up, I'll tell you. And he basically coached me through the whole thing, did all the planning and preparation.
Just quickly, what are the five stages? Can you just
planning a preparation. Yeah, planning preparation. Then you go into like the discussion stage where you spend 70% of your time understanding about what each other wants. Then when I understand your what you need and what I need, somebody's going to make the third stage a proposal. You know, we make a proposal. Then we can start bargaining, which is the fourth stage where we trade, and then fifth stage close.
Right.
So he got me totally kind of planned and prepared, got me absolutely ready, and he said, right, you run the negotiation. He said, but if you really start to struggle, look at me and I'll take over. Or if I think you're struggling, I'll give you a little kick under the table and I'll take over. And we're walking.
You've got across, like your panic buttons
yeah,
there.
Yeah, we're walking across the car park together. And he said, by the way, they'll probably have decided to outnumber us. That's a good thing. That shows they're serious. And we walk in and there's like five of them in the room.
Yeah.
And there's just the two of us. And I remember what he'd done is he'd neutralised the power play.
Right.
Because I walked in and I distinctly remember going, oh yeah, five of them. Oh.
Yeah.
Not, we're outnumbered. And I did the best I could. And then I started to get a bit out my depth. And I got kicked under the table by my boss, who just called this guy's bluff. This guy was, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to do this, Stu. We're going to do this. And he said to me earlier, he said, even if they do, he said, they probably can't, he said, because the best they can do is 10% damage, because their customers want our product, so relax. And even if they do, we'll attack them from their competitors.
Yeah.
So he did a whole thing. And he just put his, he literally went, right, put his briefcase right in the middle of the guy's desk, opens it up, takes his folder, puts it in, shuts the briefcase, and leant over and said to the guy, went, Jeffrey, I'm really sorry, just doesn't look like this is going to work out for us. I'll ask Simon to make arrangements to close the account. And I was sitting there going, what are you doing? You know, and then the customer on the other side went, whoa, I fumbled. And then my boss sat down and opened his briefcase and said, shall we have a sensible conversation? and he basically coached me for all those hours on plan, prepare, what to do, how to think, how to behave, what to say, what not to say. And he coached me for, he's my boss for about 2 years. Mm. And that was, he took like arrogant and turned it into a bit more, I hope, humble. And showed me what good really looked like. Mm. And that was really powerful lesson, I think.
And maybe that's how negotiation or the skills, execution and perception has changed, because then maybe there was a bit more of that hubris and arrogance in the 80s and 90s. You know, I love watching Wolf of Wall Street. It's brilliant, but, you know, like... No, it's not like normal real life. This podcast is called The Disruptive Entrepreneur. Mm. What does the word disruptive mean to you?
I think we... probably in our sales approach sometimes try to be a little bit disruptive. You know, we're trying to challenge what customers think is the best way to do things. You know, there'll be sometimes like I suppose we kind of disrupt what they think is going to happen in the meeting sometimes, where they think that I've got a new business meeting with a client that's contacted us, I think, the week after next. And for example, maybe they're expecting me to come in and start talking about how great we are and how good our people are and how amazing our negotiation training is. Well, I'm not going to do that because I don't know yet what they want or what they need. So I'm going to say, I may say, look, I may be different to some of the other people you're going to see, but I'm not actually planning on talking about what we might do because I don't know what you need. So, and you can sometimes see them go, oh, that's different. And, you know, and it's about...
So being different.
Being different and... You know, you can also be disrupted by really focusing on your clients and what your clients need and trying to get out your own head and get inside their head. But certainly try to be disruptive to our competitors without a shadow of a doubt.
And so how would you try and be disruptive to your competitors?
Our approach is about, but we're far more solution focused, we're far more consultative. We don't have an off the shelf offering. I'm very proud to say
so you're trying to be unique.
I don't have an off-the-shelf offering. Everything we do is tailored to each individual customer, their industry, their needs, the maturity of their sales teams, the situations they're facing.
Yeah.
There may be some fundamentals that are common, but I don't have a, you know, take this off, there you go, that's what you've got. So that's that, and that works for us. We have a pretty high strike rate, so that seems to work. I guess where we fail is if they do want off the shelf.
Of course. It can't be everything to everyone, can you?
You can't be. I mean, I think that's... Understand, know your customers, know what your ideal customer looks like and focus on those, you know? And the rest, you know, I don't know, somebody like Jeremy Clarkson, you know, is... you people love him or hate him, don't they?
Yeah.
No Marmite job. But
it's very clear that he knows who he is.
Yeah, and he knows he annoys people, and that's absolutely fine. I don't think.
It's funny. I interviewed Quentin Wilson for the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously knows Jeremy very well, and he said people used to come up to him in the street and say stuff to him, and he's just like how he's on telly in real life, and he really genuinely didn't care what anyone thought about what he said.
Yeah.
And I, in a way, like, I'm not saying I want to be like that, but I respect someone who knows who they are so much.
Yeah.
I think it's important as a business and a brand, know who you are. Don't try and be your competitors. Don't try and compete with someone who's better than you at being them.
I mean, I see it all the time in the world of professional speaking. It's obviously we're often people are inspired to become a professional speaker.
You know a Tony Robbins trained speaker a mile away, don't you?
Yes, you do. You know, and obviously Tony...
Say I!
So Tony Robbins is, and I've had the privilege of having a behind the closed doors thing with Tony, seeing Tony with about 30, 35 clients, seeing him up close and personal. And he's a very, very impressive, very impressive speaker, no two ways about it. But there's only one Tony Robbins, and that's Tony Robbins. And
well, the first year of my speaking, I didn't know, but I was basically trying to beat him.
Yeah, and obviously, and I think a lot.
Just in case there are any videos out there of me in the early days.
But artists, musicians, in their formative period, will often do cover songs. Yeah. You're very keen on it, weren't you? Will be influenced by someone, etc. But then you've got to find your own voice, and I think that is about something changes in when you're a speaker, when you're yourself on stage. You finally click and you realise, okay, this is what Simon Hazeldine does on stage, and it's very different to what Rob Moore does on stage, and it's very different to what Tony Robbins does on stage. Yes, learn from and be influenced by those people.
Yeah.
But there is really only one person who can go, say I, you know, with any...
Well, there's about 30,000 people that try it.
Yeah. And you know...
But he's got a big enough hand and a deep enough voice than most other people haven't. Simon, been a real pleasure.
Absolutely.
Really grateful for you investing your time to do this. I want to make sure you get a lot out of it too. We have people, and that's over 180 countries that people subscribe.
Oh, fantastic.
3,000 in Myanmar, and I was like, I didn't even know that was. Like, I was looking at the data. So tell us where we can follow you and find you.
Okay, so my speaker website is simonhazeldine.com, or one word, SimonHazeldine.com. The website for my latest book is neuro-cell.com. On Twitter at Simon Hazeldine, and also I've been launching a podcast specifically on sales and negotiations.
Excellent.
It's called The Sales Chat Show.
When's it come out?
It's out. It's ready now. We started a couple of months ago. So saleschatshow.com, and there's a whole host
I'll
of
have to
free
listen to
sales
that. I love
training
podcasts.
Content. Yeah, well, you'll be very welcome. Very welcome to listening. So yeah, that's how people can get hold of me.
Right, Simon, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. Cheers. Pleasure.
Thank you. Rob again, stay with me here because I've got a gift for you. I get asked for these a lot, and I thought, well, I'll leverage my time and yours, and I will put these four things I get asked a lot into a free gift for you. So if you go to tiny.cc/Rob's report, then what I've done is I've written for you an article on the top 21 apps I use to create the mobile lifestyle. I've written an article on the 14 my most favourite educational, inspirational, informative documentaries of the most inspiring people in the world. I've written which ones they are and a synopsis of each one. I'm very well known for having lots of very specific goals, detailed vision, values. So I'm sharing with you my particular document I use. I've PDF'd it for you. And also the fastest ways I know to make money for startup and scale up entrepreneurs. So I've written an article and a detailed report on each one. I've put them all into one. And all you have to do is go to tiny.cc/Rob's report. You get those for free. I'll never ask anything from you, spam you, never sell to you. And then also once a week, I'll send you a new article or a new video content that's a bit different that maybe you wouldn't get normally from the Disruptive Entrepreneur podcast. So I hope you find that useful. Remember, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything.